Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:32 p.m. here on Monday, March 17th. We are in the Belts Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building of Juneau. Unfortunately, it is not as beautiful today as it was this weekend. I just want to remind folks here in the room if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meeting are available on BASIS. They've been distributed to committee members, including an updated sexual analysis, which is also available on BASIS. And if you're looking for additional copies, they are available for you right there by the door. Members present today is President Stevens, Senator Keel, Senator Bjorkman, Senator Kronk, and myself, Senator Tobin. Please let the record reflect. We do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Naomi from the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting and Mary Gwen from Senate Records for documenting today's meeting. First on the agenda is a presentation from the University of Alaska Anchorage News Teacher Apprenticeship Program. We will also have our first bill hearing of Senate Bill 69, Education Funding, a bill to increase the base student allocation. For those who are following along at home, we will start in public testimony on Wednesday of this week for House Bill 69, so please keep that in your calendar. We are asking folks to sign up by 4:15 p.m. We will hold public testimony open until all folks who wish to speak have an opportunity to do so. With that being said, I just want to remind folks that the Irish flag is made up of three colors, one in which I wear today, so I would appreciate people to stop pinching me. All right, first item on today's agenda is a presentation from the University of Alaska Anchorage New Teacher Apprenticeship Program. We are joined by Dr. Janice Runge, who is here in the room with us. Also online for questions is Dr. Doucet, the Dean of the UAA School of Education. Thank you, and welcome to the Senate Education Committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready.
Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Denise Runge, and I currently serve as the Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor for the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I'm very pleased to join you. Thank you, Chair Tobin. It's really exciting what we have to talk about today, teacher apprenticeship, which are not words that we're used to hearing together, so we're excited to make this more a normal part of your lexicon. So the University of Alaska Anchorage's School of Ed was the first in the state, but won't be the last, to come up with a way to do a registered apprenticeship program for early childhood education in our case. So we were the first of our kind in Alaska. We began the program this fall thanks to the approval of the Board of Regents and DEED. It's really an innovative way to provide for teacher education that works super well for Alaska. And the reason it works so well for Alaska is because it is place-based. And so it's really about finding individuals who are already in a community, who are interested in a teaching career, but may not have the ability to leave their home community to go to a university campus and take a traditional route of teacher education. So it's all about providing a pathway. It does increase educational attainment, achievement, and absolutely is a way to fill the demand, which we know is so, so great for teachers in Alaska. The program has been way more successful than we ever dreamed. We'll talk about that in a moment. And we believe it holds tremendous promise. You'll hear about our program, but in the future, I'm sure you'll hear about similar programs coming from the other universities as they find ways to do this as well. So what's so innovative about the model? It's a true apprenticeship. And an apprenticeship is always made up of three parts. Well, really four if you consider the apprentice teacher. But the three main components are the employer, a sponsor, and then the education provider. So obviously UAA is the education provider in this case. We have been for several years offering a Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood Education. It is approved through DEED for teacher licensure at P through 3 levels. So we've been doing that for several years. Now we're joined by a sponsor, and in our case currently, many of the sponsors are Alaska Native corporations, but a sponsor could be an entity like DEED. There's a number of entities who could play the role of sponsor. And then there's an employer. And the key to any apprenticeship is that you're working, you're earning while you're learning. You never stop working to go get education. You work and learn simultaneously throughout the entire program. You're paid to learn. Another thing that's really vital to understand is because we have such amazing sponsors, they are providing tuition support for the students, and in some cases things like books and fees. We know that the teaching profession is much in need, but probably isn't among the highest paying professions in the state. And so we're excited because in this model, it's very unlikely that students would have any debt when they graduate with their bachelor's degree in education. So it's a great model for reducing the likelihood of debt. How does it work? Well, at UAA, we've decided to use a stacked credential model. And so students start out, often they may already be employed in a school district or perhaps in a child care center or a Head Start in their community. But, you know, maybe they're in the school district working as a paraprofessional. Maybe they're just working in the school in some other capacity. They start out with the Occupational Endorsement Certificate. This is an 18-credit program, about six classes in infant and toddler development. It's the really foundational course that helps these individuals begin to think about all the basics of student development and early learning. It also lays that foundation for making sure that reading instruction and the development of vocabulary and how all of that works is laid. With that endorsement certificate completed, they can then move seamlessly into the associate's degree in early childhood development. That's 42 credits, including or stacking on top of, rather, the 18. So a total of 60. And that one prepares them to be a teaching assistant, maybe the Head Start teacher, might be the owner of a preschool, or they can continue on into the bachelor's pathway, still working the whole time. They take another 60 credits, and at the end, they come out with a Type A P3 license from DEED. So it's a remarkable approach. Again, the key for us is that students are not ever asked to leave their home communities. We offer the education via remote learning. Local teachers come alongside and facilitate. We take as much advantage as possible of things like credit for prior learning and really do everything we can to help speed these individuals along their path. So with that, and with the permission of the chair, I'd like to invite the dean, Tanya Doucet, who is joining us online to add some more details about how this is growing our teacher workforce.
Ms. Doucet, can you hear us?
Yes.
Excellent. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Tanya Doucet, and I am the Dean for the School of Education at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Through the chair, I would like to share the amazing, nothing short of amazing results we have seen in this very first semester and starting to come upon our very first year of registered apprenticeships for teachers. We already have nearly 50 apprentices in our Alaskan communities right now. We thought we might have 10 in our first semester. So I'd like that number to sink in just a little bit there. While you're thinking about that number, 48, by the way, is the number of apprentices. I would like you to think about the fact that 63% of these apprentices are Alaska Native. That should communicate to you that this is a very community homegrown experience leaning on our Alaskan communities. These are programs that are simply expanding what we already offer to meet in a new way. This is also a way to support areas for success as we think about what creates a good teacher. So this is our opportunity to rethink teacher preparation and even consider and compare traditional to apprentice preparations. Our apprentices have dedicated teams for personalized coaching. We have an apprenticeship coordinator who is dedicated and serves as an early interventionist, conducting proactive outreach with our apprentices. We're monitoring grades, we're monitoring headlines. The moment we hear that a cable has been cut offshore, we activate and we notify faculty and we start working with the sponsors to make sure those teachers can continue their studies. We're trying to limit turnover and increase achievement with these high touch points. And ideally, we are creating opportunities for Alaskans in education. But none of these stories are as powerful as the individual stories. You see on screen three of our apprentices in the program right now, Marita, Aubrey, and Olive. These three phenomenal educators are in their home communities achieving what would not be achievable. These are professionals who have endured personal tragedies, who have escaped bad relationships and have overcome the odds, and in this program will finally become licensed teachers in Alaska. They have testimonies that will tell you that without an apprenticeship, they wouldn't be here. And that tells us that we need to be doing more to help our apprentices and to create more apprentices in the classroom.
So, through the chair, we are really excited about this program. We believe that it is an opportunity to finally begin to address the gap between the number of teachers that we need and the number of teachers that the universities can create. Not everybody can pick up and leave their community. Not everybody can do traditional education. And in a state like Alaska that's so geographically spread out, it just made sense to us to try a different model. I'm sure you have questions, and we would be very happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for this presentation. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice President, I think fourth slide talked about credit requirements, and I was not entirely sure I tracked. So to get through this program to the bachelor's, is a grand total of 60 credits, or do these all stack, grand total of 120 credits?
Through the chair, they do stack, so it is 120 credits, and that is the traditional, typical amount of credits that's needed for any of the bachelor's degrees through the university system.
Follow-up?
Well, the follow-up question would be, are they all education credits?
Through the chair, no, they're not. So like any baccalaureate degree, there's a component in general education. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly critical when you're preparing an early childhood teacher, that they have a little bit of English and a little bit of math and a little bit of history and social studies and all of those different components of science, so that they can provide that well-rounded foundation for the early learners.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. So differentiate for me then this apprenticeship program from working full-time and going to school online part-time and getting a 120-credit bachelor's degree in education.
Through the chair, this is a great question. And what we think is really the key difference is, number one, as Dean Doucet mentioned, there's a very intentional set of supports wrapped around the student. That sponsor has come in and is covering the cost of the tuition, often the books and other fees. So this student has not only no tuition to worry about paying while they're already working and going to school, but then we wrap around things like the apprenticeship coordinator, somebody who's out there and kind of coaching them and in their corner and constantly reaching out. The other key difference for now is that we're really thinking about, if you're working full-time, what's the best way to take your courses? And so many of these courses are offered in shorter semester formats, so that rather than taking four courses at once, which could be a little bit hard to focus, you maybe take one or two of them for half of the semester, then you finish and take the other group. So we're also offering it in a different schedule to really recognize that somebody is employed, and we think that they're going to be more successful because, again, if you're taking four courses and working full-time, it can be a lot.
Mm-hmm. One more.
Senator Keel.
Thanks. Appreciate the indulgence, Madam Chair. So How about the what I think of old school model as the student teaching period? Is that somehow shortened or worked in, or does that still, you got a student teach a semester after you finish your degree?
Through the chair, you don't have to do it after because it's incorporated in. And if anything, these apprentices are going to get more of that experience because they're already working inside the school, right? So they're partnered early with their mentor teacher. They're having a lot more one-on-one time in the school with the young children that they hopefully one day in the future will be the teacher of.
Thank you.
Thank you. President Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations. I mean, what a great program, because I have known every village I've ever represented, and there have been a lot of them that have come and gone, that there's always a paraprofessional there who would be a great teacher, could be a great teacher, but can't take the classes. But so my questions, I guess, I'll sort them all out here. First is, are these as qualified people as a teacher going through a regular program? Two, have you considered or are you considering going beyond P3? And three, has accreditation or lack of accreditation affected this at all?
Thank you, through the chair. So first, there is absolutely no difference in the qualification of a teacher who comes in this route versus a teacher who moves to Anchorage and takes the courses there with us. And the reason for that is they're all mixed together. They're in the same classes. They're taught by the same faculty. They have the exact same standards and requirements. And we even assess their effectiveness with the same forms and surveys and exams and all of that. So we have 100% confidence that these teachers are as well prepared as any other teachers. In terms of accreditation and in terms of future programs, so UAA, as many people know, is not currently accredited by CAPE, which is the organization that DEED expects all teacher preparation programs to be accredited by. We're in the process of working our way toward that. DEED has given us the authority to license these teachers. So that's why we have this one program, because DEED has said this is the program that you can offer, as did our Board of Regents. Once we have several years' worth of graduates from the program and several years' worth of data, in 2027, we'll go back to CAPE, apply for accreditation. We believe we'll be successful. And then once we are CAPE accredited, we can then go back to our board and to DEED and ask to add additional kinds of teacher preparation programs. So we're really in the rebuilding phase, and that's why it's limited to this one program.
Absolutely. It's very exciting what you're doing. Congratulations.
Thank you. Additional questions? Well, thank you so much for this presentation, and in full disclosure, I am writing my dissertation on alternative pathways to teacher preparation, and so I am particularly very interested in this pathway, the program that is going through UAF as well, the Grow Your Own Teachers, Alaskans Teaching for Alaska, and also some of the other programs we see coming through the Alaska Council School Administrators. So I am very excited because I think we'll have some excellent data to showcase which programs we should continue to invest in from a statewide level.
Thank you, Chair Tobin.
Thank you. Well, we'll take a brief at ease as we transition to our next presentation. Brief at ease. Back on the record here in Senate Education is 3:51 p.m. here on Monday, March 17th. We are now joined by Representative Hemshute and I believe her staff, Claire Fordyce. And they will be providing the first presentation and a brief overview of House Bill 69, which is sponsored by Representative Hemshute. Welcome to the Senate Education Committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. I'm delighted to be here today. My name is Rebecca Hemshute. I represent House District 2. That is a 500-mile stretch of beautiful coastal southeast Alaska from Yakutat to Heidelberg. I have 21 communities. I have 11 school districts, 10 tribes, and 9 village corporations. And I see that there are members of this committee who have more villages than that. So thank you for taking time today to hear House Bill 69. As we work through the bill today, we're going to talk about some of the impacts of the basically flat funding, and it's always important to recognize the one-time funds that the legislature has provided to our school districts. They've always been grateful, but the BSA is really where it's at. The BSA is our opportunity to provide the best support to our school districts. So we'll work through where this bill started, the timeline that it traveled in the House, some of the provisions that have been added in the bill through the Rules Committee and on the floor of the House, and then a little bit more detail as far as I have it on some of those provisions that were added, and then time at the end for questions. So the problem that we were originally trying to solve with House Bill 69 was the problem of flat funding in the BSA. Again, money outside the BSA has a harder time making it to the classroom or doesn't go to the classroom at all. If it's outside the BSA, you can't bargain a contract with it. You can't necessarily hire staff with it because it's hard to offer a one-year position. Sometimes you can, but when it's inside the BSA, that's money that you know will be there. So districts have had some one-time funding, but in terms of keeping up with inflation, we as a legislature have had pretty much a failed policy in school funding. So you can see that inflation has gone up by nearly 40% in the same period of time that our increase to the BSA has gone up by less than 7%. So that's the problem House Bill 69 was looking to solve. We wanted to go back to fiscal year 2011. That was the year when the BSA had, and I want to be really clear, based student allocation, which is the foundation of our funding formula. That was the year 2011 when it had the greatest purchasing power. And so if we were to restore the funding that has been eroded by inflation back to 2011, we would have to have a significant increase of about $1,808. So the original House Bill 69 provided that funding over 3 years, starting with $1,000 this year, and then it applied inflation proofing. So the original 69 would have added inflation proofing to our current BSA number of 5960. Then it would have inflation-proofed, then we would have added 404 inflation-proofed, added 404 and inflation-proofed. But that's not the House Bill 69 that's in front of us now. When we flat fund, we end up with some problems. So the problems in the top right corner of this slide are the first-day vacancy rates. So across Alaska on the first day of school in 2025, there were 600 unfilled positions, and that's for certified staff. So that means that there are 600 classrooms that should have a certified teacher that don't on the first day of school. And then below that slide, you see the emergency certificates. That wasn't even really a thing because we were able to hire teachers. And we have to recognize we're hiring in a national marketplace. So we're competing with other states, and our districts have not been able to keep up funding-wise. So teacher salaries in Alaska have fallen behind the national average, and we learned just a couple weeks ago in a new study that we're about 25% behind. So this slide shows on the bottom right corner the emergency certificates. Ideally, people come into the classroom with a certificate ready to teach. If you can't get that, next best thing might be to have somebody with an emergency certificate. They probably have some classroom experience, but they haven't necessarily finished their certification program. So you have basically uncertified teachers who are hired and calling it student teaching even when there's no mentor teacher there when they have the classroom themselves. So they're probably great educators, but they don't yet have that certificate and all the experience that goes with it. And then on the left side of the slide, you see the international hires that have started, again, as a response to being unable to fill vacancies. House Bill 69 was heard in the House Education Committee four times. We were asked to extend the amendment deadline. We did that. We received one amendment in House Education. It then traveled to we took public testimony for 5.5 hours and had over 800 emails were sent in. All of that was about 90% in support of the bill. Then it moved over to House Finance and moved very quickly out of Finance. When it entered Rules, we had been working for some time on figuring out we'd been requested to put in policies. So we needed to figure out what those policies should be. Again, I'm going to emphasize funding is a policy. When we don't fund, that's in a form, in a way, a policy as well. So, but we were asked to put in other measures in the bill besides just funding. And so that happened in the Rules Committee. And then it came to the House floor last week and had 54 amendments offered on the House floor. I'm going to do my best to represent what's now in the bill. Again, this is not the bill I started with, and so as things were added into the bill, I've done my best to keep up, but these aren't necessarily things that I have studied. So we have added to the bill, and I do have a sectional analysis we can look at. We've added to the bill open enrollment for within district, and there are 15 states looking at open enrollment this year. 9 have statutes. Some of those have only intra-district, which is within a district, some cross-districts, so it's a relatively new area of policy. The bill now expands accountability reporting to include student academic growth, so rather than measuring students by one day and their proficiency on that one day that the test was given, the bill now shifts that conversation to looking at how students grow, and Alaska is a leader in student growth. We actually make a lot of growth in our students. And then it expands authorization avenues for charter schools. For example, there's nothing in statute right now about renewing, and so charter schools go through the entire process to renew. This adds statute that that says charter schools with the right performance can continue with a more simplified process, along with other measures, shortening some timelines for appeal and that kind of thing. There is an increase in the BSA. The beauty of the BSA, once again, is that when we increase the BSA, we support all forms of public education in Alaska, whether that's a charter school, a neighborhood school, or a correspondence school. So through the BSA, we're able to support all of our schools. It offers regulations for cell phones in schools that would be locally drafted with help from the department, but it does require school districts to address the use of cell phones in schools. It adds reading proficiency incentive grants to reward students who make growth or reach proficiency in reading in grades K through 6. It establishes a task force to look at school funding. That task force could address a lot of things, maybe our transportation formula, maybe our adequacy if our funding is doing what we want it to do. Maybe it could look at insurance pooling. There are a lot of things that this task force could take on, but it requires a deeper look than we're able to do during session and committee work. And then it requires education funding to be passed early in the legislative session. So just a little bit drilling down on a couple of the policies. In our open enrollment language in House Bill 69, it allows intra-district, which means within the district. So if you don't want to go to your neighborhood school, and I've seen the beauty of neighborhood schools because where I come from, there aren't choices. You have the one school. And by children going to the neighborhood school, they all know each other in the neighborhood. They support each other. Their parents see each other at the grocery store. It's really as much a school as it is a family. But if a family chose to go to a different school outside of, I think they use the term zoned or outside their district boundaries, within their school district, they would have that option. They would need to provide their own transportation. And it would be on a first, not first come, first serve, but on a lottery basis. So rather than the first family to sign up, it would be everybody can sign up, and then the school district would make a policy for allowing numbers of kids in based on the capacity of each school. And then the charter provisions for House Bill 69 right now, again, it's the reauthorization language. Expanded appeal process, and I would have to look, like I said, there's about 7 new measures for charter schools in the bill at this point, so I want to make sure I'm getting it right and would prefer to talk about that in the sectional analysis. And then we would also establish a charter school coordinator indeed to help families wanting to start charter schools with policy and regulation guidance, with renewal, and working within districts to help support charter schools as they launch. And then the big thing, one of the big things is to move from the tests showing us proficiency in one measure in time. And again, a test is not the same as a barometer or a thermometer. You don't come up with one score and that tells you what you need to know about that kid. Rather, a test is a point in time measure of that student. And so the very next day, if a student has experienced, has come to school without breakfast or had violence in their home or just plain didn't sleep well that night, they could perform vastly differently on a test. So this moves the conversation to growth. And there's growth testing in our schools right now through the MAP. And this would require us in statute to start talking more about whether our kids grow than how they do at a point in time. And then the READS Act support that was included is incentive grants of $450 for each student in grades K through 6 who read at grade level or show improvement in reading, and it's awarded at the district level. Again, this, I personally would, under the READS Act, I know in my own home district, under the READS Act, if you have students who are not meeting benchmarks, they require after-school tutoring and summer school and that kind of thing, and this wouldn't provide support for that, but it does give a generous award to students who do meet benchmarks. That was a really rapid kind of walk through an 18-page bill, so I'm more than happy to take questions or go through the sectional analysis.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Himshu. I think to ensure that we kind of stay in some orderly fashion, how about we kind of tackle the sections as they come, potentially the first three sections which deal with the open enrollment policy or the open enrollment admittance practice that is currently outlined.
Sure.
And I believe that there was a question from from Senator Cronk.
I can read.
Okay.
Okay, so sections 1 and 2. Section 1 makes certain that a child clearly is entitled to the free public education at their assigned school or that they can travel to a school selected by their parent within their school district. And then Section 2 does conforming language and applies a 3-year sunset on that provision. And then Section 3 talks about the lottery-based enrollment and sibling priorities. So, thank you. If a student is admitted to a school that their parent chose and their sibling is not, that sibling would get preference over other kids in the lottery. Of course, all of this would be designed at the district level. And then some district reporting that they need to do to make sure that that we have the data we need to make sure that this new policy is working, and an appeal process. And then, yeah, those first three really are the open enrollment section.
Thank you. Senator Cronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the open enrollment, I just need to clarify this, that we're just talking about brick-and-mortar schools, or does that mean a student in Fairbanks wants to homeschool in Galena? They cannot do that, according to this?
No. In checking with our legal department, this does not address any of that. This only addresses within district.
For brick-and-mortar schools?
Neighborhood schools,
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
Additional questions on this particular section? I think one of the things that three of the things that I've noticed is, would this guarantee that a student has the opportunity to attend their neighborhood school, or would it require that neighborhood school have a lottery process? I'm unsure of what comes first.
Chair Tobin, I can't say for sure. Again, I'm still wrapping my mind around this language as well. My understanding is you have a right to your neighborhood school where you live as your first priority, but you can also choose to go to a school in a different neighborhood.
So one of the things I noticed in statute is there are particular provisions for our charter schools that outline their admission processes and outline how they have priority admissions. How would this impact those particular provisions and statutes?
I'm completely unclear on that. I apologize. I don't know, because I know charter schools right now will use a lottery system. So I don't know if you just would then add these kids from other neighborhoods into that same lottery, or if it's a whole separate lottery, or if it's not involved at all. I really don't fully know.
Thank you. And has there been any discussion or questions around what the administrative impact might be to school districts for the reporting?
Sorry, Chair Tobin, I don't know.
My final question is also, I see here that the reference to parents select a school and the parents potentially will submit their child's name into the lottery. Is parent defined? Is this parent guardian? Or is there other provisions around step-parents or other types of folks who might be responsible for that child?
Chair Tobin, I don't know. I would have to look at the statute, how it's written right now. I know in my school district we say family. We usually say family because it's more encompassing.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any additional questions on this particular sections 1, 2, and 3? All right. Let's move along. I believe the next sections are detailing the academic performance over time.
Yes, I wish I had made myself a little bit of a map about which sections do what, because some of them do circle back. But Section 4, again, talks about student academic performance over time, which I think we can broadly interpret as growth, being part of the district's goals and priorities that they set each year, their school improvement plan. And then Section 5 talks about that needing to be reported and using norm reference tests to make sure that that growth is not just we think they grew, but actually norm referenced. And then adding in Section 6, that language would have to be added to the performance designation that we already do, but it would be changed to talk about growth rather than proficiency. And then it talks about standardized assessments again in Section 7 to make sure that that it's not just the opinion of the teacher that the students grew, but an actual norm reference test. And then finally in Section 8, I think that's the last section. Correct. Section 8 is the last section dealing with this switch to discussing growth versus proficiency. And it says that we would no longer use the NAEP. And again, the NAEP is administered to a small selection of a subset of students every other year. About 5% of the kids in the state take it. So we've used it for a long time as our story of success or failure, and it doesn't really capture that. So we would no longer use that. Rather, we would be looking at growth. A concerning section of Section 8 is only allowing 3 hours of instructional time to take the test. And I keep saying test. It's really an assessment. And assessments can take quite a bit of time. Right now, if you do MAP testing, MAP assessment, that's 3 times a year, fall, winter, and spring. And some students need longer than others. So to limit that to 3 hours would be difficult at best or really impossible. So that's a concerning section of that.
Other questions around this section? President Stevens.
Just a couple questions. I appreciate the position you are in, defending a village you did not entirely write, but could you help me with the NAEP? I mean, my understanding is that federal funds come because of NAEP, and if we do not do NAEP testing, are those federal funds no longer available? And the second question, no, really has to do with funding. Can we talk about that? Yeah, so people are telling me that we're talking about a BSA increase and that people are saying it's not going to affect charter schools or homeschool, but my understanding is this would follow every student, wherever you are, whatever program you're in our school system.
Thank you. Through the chair, President Stevens, thank you for those excellent questions. I expressed concern on the floor. I do want to embrace growth over proficiency, but I am not certain that we don't have to report on the NAEP. I'm not sure what the federal requirement is, and I haven't had a chance to ask about that. And then your second question about the BSA, it absolutely supports every type of school. So if we infuse the system with a little bit more support, that will go to homeschool students, that will go to charter students, and that will go to neighborhood schools.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. For the record, I want to note that Representative Holland and Representative Story joined us at 4:10 p.m. Additional questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the NAEP question, I mean, this is in the section about the Department of Education giving every school a performance designation. So I guess I didn't read this as Alaska kids won't take NAEP and nobody will report Alaska NAEP scores. Only that they won't go into the, what is that, the STARS? Or anyway, the individual performance designations. Can you help me sort of tease that out?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Keel. My understanding is that the NAEP will still be given. It's just that we would no longer use that as our measure in statute of the success or failure of a school. But I'm not 100% certain on that. That's my understanding.
Thank you.
Any additional questions on this section? I have two, and one's particular to Section 4, which it would require a school district to report on progress and academic growth. However, from my understanding, DEED already collects this information and reports on it for districts. So would this put more administrative burden on districts to report those information versus simply continuing to allow DEED to do that work? I'm a little bit confused about why we'd want districts and DEED reporting on the same set of information.
Chair Tobin, thank you for that question. I can't say for sure. I do know that right now, if you look at the progress report, what is that called on the DEED website?
Report card,
thank you. The report card for the public on the DEED website already has this information, and so maybe it's redundant and districts don't actually have to do anything more. I really couldn't say. I do know that that information is available already.
And I have an additional question. With what I see in the Section 8 of the legislation, that schools and districts may not use more than 3 hours of instructional time in a school year to conduct assessments. I know along with the AK Star and progress mapping, we also have the Alaska Reads Act reading proficiency assessments. How would this might impact other types of assessments that educators do in the classroom, as you have experienced as an educator in a classroom?
Thank you for the question. I wasn't a K-3 educator, but I do know each DIBELS test is supposed to take only 1 minute. But add all those minutes up, plus the MAP testing, plus if you're selected for NAEP. And then really the term assessment, is it formative assessment also? Because that could be super tricky. That's the weekly spelling test or whatever other little things. So that would probably benefit from a little more fleshing out.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarity. Any additional questions before we move ahead? Seeing none, please proceed.
The next few things, thank you, Chair Tobin. The next few things deal with charter schools. Section 9 reduces the time that the state board has to issue a decision if a charter school is denied, if their application is denied, from 90 days to 45. And then Section 10 specifies that before a school board can terminate a charter, there's opportunity to remedy whatever the issue is that might cause the termination. Section 11 allows charter schools to carry over 10% of their unreserved budget annually. And some districts allow charter schools to carry a fund balance. Some don't. Some cap it at 10%. Some don't. So this is something that is done in some places already. And then Section 12 is a new section that allows a charter school to appeal to the commissioner when a local board terminates a contract and requires the commissioner to issue a written decision on the appeal within 90 days. And then Section 13 shifts the administrative indirect costs that a school district can deduct from the charter school's budget from 4% to 8%. That was formerly 10%, so they're trying to find just the right spot. So 10% was more than they needed. 4% is not quite enough, so shifting to 8% to see if we can find the sweet spot. And then Section 14 specifies that charter school contracts can be renewed for successive terms. Right now, I don't think that's addressed in statute. And then Section 15 adds a charter school coordinator to the Department of Education. And that's the section on charter schools.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to Section 13, instead of an arbitrary number for administrative costs that a charter school would have to remit money essentially back to the district for, I wonder if it wouldn't be appropriate to just have a school district keep track of administrative costs and essentially bill a charter school for those things, like an interagency transfer or some other model. I wonder who would come out ahead in that scenario. Has that been considered?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, to my knowledge, I don't know that it's been considered. I'll just offer that some of those administrative costs are things like record keeping and test administration. You know, you have to have a district test coordinator, for example, for the WIDA access and tests that not every student is taking. Some of the special ed paperwork, all of that kind of thing. So I think it might be difficult to calculate what percent of that. You know, maybe it could be done. Can't say for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Keel. President Stevens.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Actually, back to Section 12. So a school board, for whatever reason, decides to terminate a charter school, and then there can be an appeal to the Commissioner of Education with a written decision and within 90 days. Does that mean the commissioner then can force the school district to keep that charter school in its district, even though they don't think it's a legitimate school, whatever reason? But does that force them to remain in that district and continue to manage that charter school?
Through the chair, President Stevens, that is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Keel.
One of the Jessies, anyway. Thank you, Madam Chair. The first question was about that appeal process, because I think the Senate President noted the status quo. But I guess the question I had about having the deadline for the state board to act, I'm trying to make sure that we're not forcing an ill-considered review if we don't have sufficient time or information. Sometimes reviews could as easily be political as substantive. We don't want that. So as I read the statute, it looks like the commissioner has time to look at the school board's record, possibly supplement the record, and then issue the commissioner's decision. Is it your understanding that this 45 days then in any way limits the commissioner, or does it only limit the state board after the commissioner has gone through her process or his?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, there are two different things here. In Section 9, the 45 days has to do with the denial of an application, mm-hmm. and Section 12 has to do with the termination of an existing contract. So they're slightly different things. I will, however, say that the state board meets quarterly, so making a 45-day deadline would be off cycle for them. I don't know if that would present issues.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that the commissioner has a deadline before that, so that may be something manageable for the commissioner with the board that employs her. I had another question on the charter school renewals.
I'm not sure about the problem that needs solving on the language that local boards may renew a charter school's charter. I think the one here in Juneau has been running without interruption since long before my two college students were born. What problem is this language solving?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I believe it might not have made it in the sectional analysis, but it says it, as simplified a process as possible. The problem we were hearing about is that a charter school is welcome to renew, but they basically go through their entire application process again. This was intended to not only say in statute that they have the ability to renew, but also that process is simplified.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That actually leads me on to my next question, which was, as simple as possible is quite a statement to put in statute. That sounds like one email. We'd like to keep going. Are we all done there? Is that the limit on that this language places on a board's review?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would have to look closer at the bill. I think it was the local school board sets as simple as possible a process, so it could be a single email if that's what the local board deemed adequate.
What would be simpler than that?
Through the chair, I can imagine a statement of we'd like to continue without even an email would be simpler than that.
If I may, Madam Chair, I guess
follow up.
Maybe some substantive review is okay. We may want to talk about fine-tuning that language. I have had several questions in a row, Madam Chair. I don't want to dominate. I think I have one or two more.
If it's all right, I might move to President Stevens, then back to you. President Stevens.
Thank you. The question we already talked about, and we can return to that. The State Board of Education overturning a decision by a local school board. Have you looked into the constitutionality of that? I mean, in the Constitution, we do have the issue of local control, I believe. And have you had an opportunity to look at that?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I have not.
It might be nice to get a legal opinion on that.
That is noted. President Stevens, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, a question on the indirect cost cap. Do you know what the Department of Education and Early Development charges as its indirect on federal grants?
Through the chair, I don't know. I think it's variable. I don't think it's always the same amount, but I don't know what that range of amounts is. And the chair might know, but I don't.
Okay. Madam Chair, I guess I don't have a philosophical objection to some sort of cap on the indirect, but it might be worth figuring out whether we're close to the sweet spot or not. I don't know what EED's indirect is. I know that Alaska DOT is a substantial indirect, that the university makes that look minuscule. And so, we could go all kinds of ways here. It would be worth hearing perhaps from some of the financial people about what's in the realm of reason so that we set a cap that makes sense.
Chair Tobin, if I could follow up on one question on Section 11 through the chair, Senator Keel. It does say the renewal process must be as simple as possible. So the word process leads me to believe the local board would ask for something more than just an email.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Keel. And we will take note and potentially invite some folks from our 32 school districts that currently have operational charter schools to ask for some of their insight on administrative costs and overhead. I do know that federal indirect rate, particularly for tribal organizations, is also quite substantial. So that is a consideration. Is there additional questions? I do have one, and I just want to know, as I have reached out to our legislative legal department and asked them around this language on appeal of a terminated contract, and our legislative legal did direct me to Alaska Statute 43.82.445, which is part of the administrative termination of a contract, And it was their understanding that because a contract is an administrative component of a school board's relationship with another entity, that if there was a termination of a charter school contract, it would go through this process, which also meets provisions that have been included in earlier sections of this bill that would allow for a charter school to fix any issues that might have arisen or be identified by the school board prior to termination. And then also, if the school board did terminate the contract, they would be allowed to go through a court proceeding to state their case. So I think there's some confusion about what happens when a contract is terminated. What particular pathway does it go toward? So I think there's some different ways that we could consider Section 12, particularly as that AS 43.82.445 have quite a few more protections for, I think, charter schools included in it than is currently drafted in Section 12.
Thank you for the feedback.
Any other questions? The last thing I just want to note, in all of this, the one piece that I found potentially concerning was that Section 14 identifies that a charter school could be renewed for successive terms, but it doesn't very clearly stipulate an excessive term is an additional 10 years. And I think in terms of what we've heard from some of the charter school community and from the school board community, when there is an application that maybe has some concerns or raises flags, that there should be some ability for a local school board to require additional checks and balances to ensure that that charter school is providing and meeting state statute and also requirements for record keeping and student learning that are outlined. So I'm not entirely sure. Those are just different things that I've heard from some of our stakeholders. So it's a section that I would love to delve a little bit more into.
And it does say, Chair Tobin, Section 14 does say a contract for a charter school may be for a term of not more than 10 years. So it sounds like a district could say we'll try this for 5 years, but I'm not fully certain.
So seeing no additional questions, let's move on next to the sections dealing with, I believe, correspondence programs.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. I think there's really only one section on that. Section 16 takes the report that was generated from House Bill 202 last year, which was my colleague from the Palmer area. The bill topic was different from this, but did involve making sure that Narcan kits and training were available in schools. And added to that bill at the end of session was another education measure, which was a report on correspondence schools with information about enrollment, demographics, fund use, assessment scores, and curriculum reviews. And then that report would then be added to or given to the State Board of Education under Section 16. So rather than it sunsetting, it would be the sunset would lift under Section 16 of this bill, and it would become an annual report.
Thank you. President Stevens.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I read a recent poll that was done around the state, and pretty clearly Alaskans want to know that we are spending monies wisely, that we are educating our children, they are accomplishing what they should accomplish, and that when they go through our school system, they can be a success. My concern is the we do provide a requirement for assessment scores in correspondence programs, but there's a generous opt-out so that I don't recall the percentages. Maybe you do recall, like 16% of the kids in correspondence take tests, whereas 80% in brick-and-mortar school take tests. So have you considered, did you consider adding to that, to that in that section that that more students be required to take tests? I mean, and I will tell you one thing, that we had an interesting program a couple of years ago, maybe sometime in the last 2 years, a young woman was talking about her children and saying she loved the homeschool program because if they lost it, her children could no longer take horseback riding lessons. And I'm thinking, wow, my kids never had horseback riding classes in school. So I'm concerned about if that money is being spent wisely. Are we getting the results that Alaskans demand of all of our students, whatever they're in correspondence our charter schools or in brick-and-mortar schools. So have you considered changing that opt-out so it's not quite so generous?
Through the chair, President Stevens, thank you for that question. That was not part of the amendment that brought this language into the bill, and I didn't seek to add more to it. But I think there's room for that. That opt-out language applies to all public school children. It's just that in the brick-and-mortar schools, you have a testing rate of around 92%, and in the homeschools, it's around 14%, which brings that 92 down to like an 80-something percent overall in all of our public schools. And so I do know some districts tie or increase the allotment for students who choose to test. There are issues with testing in homeschool, and I think those would need to be examined. You can't, if the student is taking an online test, which all of our, I shouldn't say all, as far as I know, in most districts, almost all of our nationally normed tests are delivered online. So who would the proctor be in a homeschool environment? So there are situations where it could be very difficult for a homeschool family to test. With, you know, mom as proctor is not probably a great testing environment. So there are some barriers there, but I do know there's been widespread interest in trying to really drill down on the accountability we want to make sure we have in all of our public schools.
Thank you. I knew you would know those percentages. 92% in brick-and-mortar schools, 14% in homeschools. Do the testing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. I would also note that we see lower graduation rates across the state with our homeschool students, and that gives me significant pause and concern as we want to ensure that our kids are career ready when they graduate from high school.
And Chair Tobin, some of those students enter homeschool as a credit recovery option, and so a lower graduation rate makes some sense, but we need to be really mindful of how low, and it's something we should monitor.
Any additional questions? Moving on.
Let's see. Section 17, again, circles back to the need to shift from the idea of proficiency and shifting more in the direction of growth. And that's the determining where the department will intervene with districts. So our lowest performing districts get support from the Department of Education, and this would include then the growth testing for determining which districts need that extra support. Section 18 requires that the correspondence school report be included in the State Board of Education's annual report to the legislature. So the correspondence report is given to the State Board, and then they would add that to their annual report that we already get from them. And then Section 19 is more conforming language. Section 20 is where we begin the section on a statute to require the governor to create a separate budget for schools and the legislature to act on that budget by March 15th. And that is also in Section 21. Is that a good place to pause, or?
Any questions regarding the, and I think there's some additional language in the bill related to those provisions, but if you just want to provide kind of a brief summary of what that section regarding, I think it's also Section 27 and Section 28.
Right. Like I said, some of this circles back later where Section 27 and 28 deal with the governor preparing that separate appropriation bill on that same deadline of December 15th that she or he has now. And then the bill requires the legislature to pass the education funding appropriation by March 15th. So that's also in Section 27 and 28, tied back to the sections we just went over.
Are there any questions on this particular provision? Seeing none.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. Section 22 is near and dear to my heart. We did remove the escalators of the 400 foreign successive fiscal years to try to reach a compromise that people could support. We've had a BSA increase offered in the last four legislatures. None has made it to the finish line. Again, when we fund inside the BSA, that allows districts some predictability and stability and the ability to do some bargaining, to really focus on funding that they know they'll have going forward and how they'd like to spend that. So that's often going to be in the form of increased salaries for educators, and it does go directly to the classroom. Section 23 is the reading incentive grant at $450 per student for kindergarten through sixth grade. This was amended in the Rules Committee, and Section 24 conforming changes to, tragically, I used the wrong terminology in the Rules Committee and really, really made an uproar. We are not repealing the Reads Act. It already has a 2034 repeal on it, so it's not new. But we had to have some conforming language when it repeals that this language would continue on past that sunset date. And then Section 25 requires the department to address cell phone use in schools. And there are exceptions allowed for whatever policy local districts come up with. The exceptions that must be included are medical, translation, emergency, or educational use. And it's also allowed in some of our smallest districts, well, anywhere, but I think it's added for the small districts that a superintendent or teacher might allow students to use the cell phones despite the policy or in addition to the policy. So, and a school district can adopt the model policy established by the department, or it may adopt its own policy, but it must do something. Inaction is not an option.
Great. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding Section 23, specifically subsection 2. Does that language, does that extend the Reads Act requirements for teachers to grades 4 through 6? Will those teachers have to get additional training like K through 3 teachers have, either in letters or the other modalities? What does that mean?
Thank you for the question, Senator Bjorkman. Through the chair, it's just that it had to be written separately for grades 4 through 6 because they don't take the DBLS and the other Reads Act benchmark testing. Rather, this would be some other form of ELA testing, English Language Arts testing at those grade levels. So it doesn't impact the educators. It's just that to know who's met the requirement would require a different measure, so it had to be written in a different section.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then a question about Section 25 and the cell phone policy. We heard a cell phone policy bill here in Senate Education last week that I guess was less squishy, to use a technical term. We heard from principals, and it's my experience as an educator, the squishy policies on cell phones are not effective at all. Could you talk to us a little bit about the rationale as to why this language was chosen for a cell phone piece rather than something a little more firm?
Through the chair, Senator Bjorkman, this language came from another bill in the House, but I will add that in my own home district, there was a – we've managed cell phones in our middle school. Managed means banned for the last at least 5 years. And so local school boards and local principals and school leaders can often find the policy that works for them, whether it's squishy or not. So this was language that was easy to find because of a bill that was already on the move in the House.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On these proficiency incentive grants, can you help me reorient my head? We've talked about a lot of tests. These K through 3 and then subsequently 4 through 6 tests, we give these once a year? How often do we give these?
Through the chair, I think the chair could speak better to that, Senator Keel. I'm not familiar with where the READS Act landed, but you give the tests until the child is proficient, and I think they have to be proficient three times, something like that, in the K-3 range. But I welcome correction.
Thank you, Representative Hemshue. If you're proficient the first assessment, you don't take any of the additional assessments. If you show that you're struggling, there's the option to take the second and third to showcase and to help the educator understand if you are moving toward proficiency.
Thank you. Each year?
Each year.
Okay.
And through the chair, I would add, I believe there's continuous progress monitoring throughout the year. So proficiency is when you've been able to test three times and show proficiency, but in the absence of that benchmark of proficiency, you would continue to be monitored and to test frequently.
So, Madam Chair, then showing improvement, unexpected skills in any one of those three gets you the grant, or improvement all the way across all three, or I should say the subsequent two if you don't qualify on one. What is the qualifier for the money?
Through the chair, I anticipate that would be spelled out in regulation.
Madam Chair, perhaps the legislature would care to say when the money gets spent rather than leaving that to someone else. I think there's a constitutional separation of powers issue there.
Thank you, Senator Keel. And I also just want to note that on line 25, it indicates the statewide screener. Which so far I understand that many of our schools have adopted DIBELS, but not all, and that there's also the provision in the Alaska READS Act to allow for alternative screeners or for a student portfolio, which I would be concerned that that's also not included in this language. And so you might have folks who are immersion students learning indigenous languages where there is not established screener yet, and they would be prohibited from receiving these dollars, and that causes me concern. I do want to note that we're at 4:43, and we do have an invited testifier, and so we'll continue on with this walkthrough up until 4:50, and then we will bring up Superintendent Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Tobin. I think I left off at Section 26, which is conforming language for Sections 27 and 28 about the appropriations bill by March 15th. Section 29 is again related to shifting the conversation from proficiency to growth. And I think if we could just skip ahead to Section 31.
Can I ask just one quick question about Section 29? Because I see here it repeals the ability for schools to receive a special designated based on performance, and also has some language around schools that receive certain types of federal funding, like Title I. And so I'm just curious in this particular section if there would be any impact to schools who do receive a special designation by our state regarding maybe some of their performance standards or their low-income standards or their students who might have a propensity to have a majority of the students who are low-income, and this might impact some of their designations to receive those federal dollars. As I know that there are schools that get all free lunch because they're designated as a full Title I school. And so can you speak a little bit more to this section and how it might impact any of those federal funding streams?
Through the chair, I apologize. I don't know those details. Okay to move on. All right, Section 30 repeals the open enrollment provision after 3 years, so we'll give it a try, see how it's going, and revisit it. Section 31 establishes a task force on education funding to analyze funding and accountability and make recommendations and submit a report. That task force could look at any number of things in our system, including the very basics of the foundation formula, could look at our transportation formula, could look at insurance pooling, lots of things. And then Section 32 asks the Department of Education to make recommendations to reduce the regulatory and statutory burdens on school districts, and that is basically a report on reports to let us know which things are really not used or not useful or not required either federally or in directing the work of the department. And the rest of these are conforming and repealing language.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hemshue. Are there any additional questions before we move on to invited testimony? Seeing none, thank you so much. Anticipate that you'll be back here on Wednesday as we go through the fiscal notes. In addition, provide any opportunity at that time for committee members who might have thought of additional questions. With that, we will move on to your invited testifier. Joining us is the superintendent of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District, Superintendent Robbins, who I recently learned also was the principal at Tuxuk Bay. Superintendent Robbins, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to testify in support of HB 69. For the record, my name is Michael Robbins, and I have the honor of serving as a superintendent of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. And before that, I was principal of Tuxuk Bay Nelson Island School, the home of the Islanders, state champs in 2022 in basketball, for the record. I speak in support of HB 69, a bill that is critical to breaking the cycle of budget cuts, frustration, and division that has been weighing down our schools in Alaska for far too long. Schools should be a place where we come together, where parents, families, teachers, school boards, communities, legislators rally around a common goal, doing what's best for kids, investing in them and their future. But let's be honest, that is not what's happening in Alaska right now. Instead, for years and years, we have been stuck in this exhausting cycle of division over school funding. Every year, districts across the state struggle to balance budgets that don't stretch far enough. Every year, we have to make impossible choices about which programs to cut, which staff to reduce, which students will lose access to something that could change their lives. Administration has been cut first to protect the classroom. In my district, we have cut the deputy superintendent, curriculum director, technology director, and a vice principal. Only 1.7% of our district budget is made up of district office administration. In some cases, school board meetings have turned into battlegrounds, people pointing fingers instead of working together. It's not just happening in Ketchikan. It's happening across the state, and it's tearing communities apart, pitting board members against teachers, teachers against administration, parents against schools, and schools against the state, including students and parents crying at the House Education Committee, if you watched that. One of the most overlooked but most critical aspects of education funding is its direct connection to the economic development. Investing in our schools isn't just about improving test scores. It's about building a stronger workforce, attracting businesses, and creating long-term economic stability for Alaska. This includes my district, where we are part of the apprenticeship program that we talked about earlier, and trying to find teachers and having over 600 openings in the state causes a crisis, not only for our administrators who have to hire, but also our students. Here's the reality. A strong education system attracts families and businesses. Companies want to set up in communities where their employees can send their kids to high-quality schools. A well-educated workforce drives economic growth. When students graduate with strong literacy, math, and career skills, they are better prepared to enter the workforce, fill high-demand jobs, and contribute to the economy. HB 69 is more than a school funding bill. It's an economic investment. It's a chance to strengthen our schools, prepare our workforce, and build a future where Alaska is a place where people want to live, work, and invest. Let me paint the picture of Ketchikan. Over the past 2 years since I've been superintendent, this is my third year, we've cut 22.2% of our staff, going from 415 employees to 323. Our career and technical education programs have been slashed. That means fewer opportunities for kids to learn real-world skills and find pathways to careers. Specifically, our aviation program, culinary arts program, and our maritime program has been reduced or eliminated. We have cut back on summer school programming for middle schoolers. Our pupil-to-teacher ratio has increased at the middle and high school by 7 students, and our elementary school by 5 students. We have cut back our district office, and this may not seem like a big deal to some, but it's affected everything from curriculum development to grant writing. In my first 2 years as a school district, we brought in over $5.5 million in grants. This year, we've brought in $0 because we don't have the people to manage or write our grants in our district office. The $1,000 student increase in the base allowance to education, what does that mean for us? It just doesn't mean more money for schools. It helps our close our $5.8 million deficit that we would have. It helps support and rebuild our RTI MTSS program for our 4th through 6th graders. And our 4th through 6th graders that we currently have were the students that were involved with COVID and shutdowns. And a lot of our schools, particularly in Western and Northern Alaska, where I was at in Tuxuk Bay, we didn't go to school for a year. And then when we came back, we were wearing masks. And all those who know about language development and the mimicking of language, and I hear this from my mother all the time, who was a preschool and elementary teacher for a long time, that was lost. And then where are those students sitting right now? They're sitting in 4th through 6th grade. But because we'd have Reads Act, and we agree with the Reads Act, and we love the things that it does, but it also impacts our 4th through 6th graders because we don't have the money to put into response to intervention or MTSS. And so those students, those three grades that we currently have right now, are kind of a lost grades in our schools. One of the most important aspects of HB 69 is the investment in early literacy through the Reads Act and the incentive model for student growth. Our K-3 reading scores need to improve, and we know that when students are reading at grade level, by the end of third grade, their chances for long-term for academic success skyrocket. But if they do fall behind in these early years, it's a long uphill battle to catch up. The bill provides the funding and support to create sustainable literacy interventions that will help our students. This is more than just one-time funding. It builds long-term literacy systems that we need in our schools, not only at kindergarten through third grade, but kindergarten through sixth grade. And also this, too, is it creates our reading teachers in the high school. So you can have students who know how to read, but if they don't know how to read content, right? I can read a medical journal, but I don't have any idea what it means or how to understand it until I have context applied to it. And that's critically important. And so the resources that we're given for Reads Act help as a domino effect or a waterfall effect for our high school teachers. We are in favor of this in Ketchikan. And we believe that if this gets through, this will significantly help our school district and significantly help our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent Robbins. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I appreciate your comments. I do want to note that I've heard it from a few folks across the nation in the different education circles that I spend time in that we keep talking about our 4th and 5th and 6th graders mm-hmm. as the lost generation. And I don't think that's acceptable for any of us here in this room and on this dais to consider a group lost because we've refused to invest in making sure that they make up for their learning loss. So please know that everyone here at this dais is going to work their dangdest to ensure that you get the resources you need.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Seeing as there's no other business before us today, this concludes our agenda. Are there any final comments from committee members? Seeing none, I just want to note once again that on Wednesday and Friday, we will open public testimony, and I intend to keep public testimony open until everyone has a chance that wishes to speak to speak. As there is no other business before the Senate Education Committee today, I will adjourn us at 4:55 p.m.